Part 3. Our Gates and Oaths Broken. Chapter 12. Solitarium. I am here. Battlefield of Time. Battle Barge Anktowe, Suprasolar Gulf. Arzek Ahriman, chief librarian of the Thousand Suns Legion, watched as blood formed in the crystal sphere. Crimson puffed into being within its polished depths, swirled and then ran to the edge of the orb. Cold light gathered around it, and Ahriman heard the melody in his mind change as notes and harmony shifted. He watched the orb for another second as it spun on through the space above him. "Does that fall within the necessary conjunction?" Ahriman spoke in thought.
"It does," croaked Menkara's thought reply.
Ahriman could feel fatigue bleeding out of the sending. He understood why. To be in this chamber was to feel and hear the flow of the immaterium without break or moderation. It was a solitarium, like those once used by long-dead scholars to predict the movements of the heavenly bodies across Terra's skies. In those devices, stone and glass spheres had turned around a crystal simulacrum of the sun. In this chamber, the same basic principle applied, but there the similarity ended. Just as the telescopes of ancient astronomers concentrated the light of the heavens, so did this chamber draw the infinite resonance of the warp down to the point where its patterns were visible. A constellation of spheres and disks turned in the space above him, its outer elements spinning wide enough to almost touch the curved walls. The whole chamber was a sphere itself, 81 cubits in diameter, cut by telekinesis from a single block of jade. No living hand had ever touched its surface or polluted it with memory. The spheres and coins of the solitarium at its centre moved on psychic currents. Most represented the physical solar system, but others, principles no less real but ultimately intangible, spun beside them. Strength ascendant, the justice of winter, the crow's flight. The smaller spheres and disks were made of rock, metal and bone, taken from the planets, moons and void bodies that lay within the light of Sol. Each planet was a sphere of crystal, formed in the warp by will alone, and brought into reality by sacrifice. When the final component had been set in place, the resonance had created a delicate shriek that had killed the last of the 81 psychic craftsmen who had made it. Since then, the sound of its turning had ached through Ahriman's mind, even when he was not in the chamber. It had been a vile price to pay. But there would be worse yet. Of that he was certain. Ahriman and Ignis floated through the arrangement on silver discs. Both of them would leave as soon as this reading was complete. Out beyond its curved walls, the Anktowe plunged on towards its goal, moved by the half-lost science of machines. But in here, as the sea of souls fled past, they were standing still, looking out upon a growing hurricane. Only Menkaura would remain in the solitarium throughout the ritual. The war augur sat on his own disk, which hung upside down relative to Ahriman, next to the golden sphere of the sun. Tarnish had spread across the silver of the disk, and Menkaura looked ragged and half-dead. The lacquer had peeled from his armour, and rust scabbed its plates. His head was bare, and the empty sockets of his eyes glowed with ghost-light and wept pus. The sound of a diamond quill-tip scratching on glass broke the quiet. Ahriman looked over to where Ignis was marking a line of calculations on a sheet of obsidian. The master of the Order of Ruin looked up, the geometric tattoos on his face sliding into a new pattern. Ahriman sent a whisper of query by thought. In the solitarium chamber, every thought was a shout, every sending a scream.
"The progress overall is within the calculations supplied by the Primarch of the Fourth and his warsmiths," replied Ignis. There are errors in the specifics that will need to be compensated for in the numeration of the final formulation.
That is what happens when plans touch reality, St. Ahriman. Things fall apart.
Ignis blinked, the patterns reforming again on his face as he considered the statement.
In some cases, he replied,
and then went back to his calculations and the diamond quill's scratching whine. Ahriman watched Ignis for a second, and then let his sight move back to the spheres. His eyes moved between them, noting the path and details of each. Emotions and visions from across the gulf of space yanked at his thoughts as he did so. The face of a human pressed into a crawl space, trying to make themselves small, as giants in midnight blue armor stalked past, their vox speakers screaming the cries of those who had already been found. A powerless ship drifting through the dark, those within clinging to their last, shallow breaths as the air ran out. A warship tumbling over and over, blazing like a torch, as its death fires fed on the fuel within its drives. Ahriman cut the visions away with a pulse of will, and steadied his mind in the thought patterns of the ninth enumeration. He felt a breath briefly frost the inside of his helm. To observe the Solitarium was not just to see it with your eyes, but to be part of it, to feel it turning as it tried to pull you into its whirlpool embrace.
You are discomforted, stated Ignis.
Ahriman did not answer, but looked at Menkaura and opened his thoughts to send them.
It can still be undone, said Menkaura,
sending the answer to the question Ahriman was about to ask.
The balance of resonances in the arrangement is such that it is not certain. Everything is blindness and dust on the wind.
Ahriman felt another question rise in his mind, and then let it fall. Ever since Menkaura had taken on the penance of watching the configuration, his thoughts and words had strayed into prophecy, as though his mind and will were kites dragged by storm winds into distant lands of perception. For all his skill of foresight and mastery of the occult, Ahriman found that he was disturbed by what was happening to his brother. Come, he said to Ignis, and turned his silver disc with a flick of will. It floated down to the lone opening cut in the chamber wall. His eyes flashed across a blue and white spun sphere as he turned, and he...
Blue and white stones in his hand, rounded by water, their faces dancing with patterns of herons and serpents, the fire and bloodlight of the sun setting through Terra's haze of pollution, the smell of the dust and the static tang of a building storm. The clack as Ormuzd placed three stones into the recesses of the old wooden board and smiled up at him.
"What is it, brother?" "Can't think what move to make," asked his twin.
Ahriman pulled his senses back and the vision drained from his sight. Menkaura was looking down at him from the other side of the turning orbs and discs. The eyeless seer had his head cocked to the side, and Ahriman could feel the mind behind the empty sockets regarding him.
"It is a cruel thing to return home and find it changed, but not as changed as we are."
Menkaura's words lingered as an echo in Ahriman's skull as he let his disc sink through the opening in the chamber wall. Ahriman pulled the helm from his head as soon as he was outside the Solitarium. Around him, the Ankh-Tarwe hummed with the familiar sounds of a ship under power, the buzz of power conduits and the rumble of distant engines. It felt reassuringly real. He took a breath and reached out with his mind, skimming over the thoughts of his brothers and crew. All was well. Their small fleet was still on course and unseen. They had left the great flock of Abaddon's armada and the Mechanicum fleet far behind. Now they were few again, all but alone in the night, heading for a distant speck of light. He sent a brief thought to touch the psychic bonds between him and the word-bearers that rode at their sides. He did not linger over the contact, and he came away with the taste of ashes on his tongue. He shivered and lowered his thoughts into the lesser enumerations.
"You do not
like this," said Ignis from behind him. Somehow his thoughts had been disturbed enough that he had not noticed his legion brother at his shoulder.
"No,"
replied Ahriman, still tasting ashes in his mouth as he spoke. "No, I do not like it."
"I know,"
said Ignis, looking at him with an utterly unchanged expression.
"I have already made and stated that observation."
Ahriman turned away.
"The question that attends the observation is why you perceive our circumstances as you do?" asked Ignis.
Ahriman let out a breath and looked back at the master of the Order of Ruin. "I do not like what we are doing for every reason," he said. "For every reason, brother." Freighter ship Antaeus, Jovian Gulf. Door slamming open. There was a metallic taste in Mercedes' mouth. Heavy metal on metal footsteps. Vengeful spirit. She was on the vengeful spirit. There were bodies heaped on the deck. Limbs tangled, flesh ripped, blood pooling. Something rose from the gore. Slicked fur, red muzzle, dripping fang grin.
Mercedes?
She knew it was a space marine even before the impossibly huge shadow fell over her.
Mercedes, wake up!
A moon high in the winter sky, its face a curve of silver, now a dividing line of light and dark.
Mercedes, wake up! Wake up now!
She turned to see a shadow form behind her, the War Master's equerry. Malachurst was known as the Twisted, as much for his labyrinthine mind as the horrible injuries that had broken his body and left him grotesquely malformed.
"Loken," he said. "These are civilians."
"I can vouch for them," said Loken. Malachurst turned his eyes to her. A hand fell on her shoulder.
"Wake up now!"
The hand on her shoulder shook her. She opened her eyes. The smell of blood and spilt organs filled her mouth and nose. Her head arched up and she vomited. Red light was flicking through the passage. On, off, on, off. For a moment the walls and decking swam and warped.
Vengeful spirit. She was on the...
She was on the Antaeus.
Mercedes!
She looked up. Nihlus was crouching beside her, his long fingers just withdrawing from where they had shaken her shoulder. The navigator's skin was white, the shadows soaking up the red blinking light. His eyes were wide. He looked as though he was about to be sick himself, or about to run.
"Where?"
she began. But then she remembered Colm, saw the flicker skip of movement, the bodies of the crimson troopers torn to shreds, and then the flare and kick of the pistol, and Colm's head coming apart. No, that was the dream. The dream. She twisted, eyes going to the gore on the walls and floor, the heaps of meat and cloth, the gun lying next to her on the deck. Fresh bile surged up her throat and splattered the deck. Nihlus flinched back.
"Where are the children?"
she gasped, pushing herself up. Nihlus jerked his head to where two small shapes lay slumped against the wall. Further down the corridor, Axinia lay beside the open door hatch. Her weapons were still in her hands beside her. Blood had soaked her clothes black. A last additional gunshot wound had ripped a hole in her neck. Her eyes were open, but they would see nothing any more. Mercedes lunged for the children, found warmth in their hands.
"Catatonic,"
said Nihlus.
"Whatever happened here?"
But Mercedes was shaking the girl and boy, not listening to the navigator.
"Mori, Noon, listen to me. You have to wake up. We have to get to the shuttle," said Nihlus,
his voice rising from cold to shrill.
"I didn't see anyone alive coming here, and the engines are still on. I think all the crew are dead. We are rudderless."
"We're not going to the shuttle."
"If they killed the crew, then this is a tomb."
"No," Mercedes snarled. Her head snapped up to look at the navigator. He took a step back.
"There are hundreds of people on this ship, and I am not leaving them to die while I run."
"Well, that did not stop you before."
"It does now."
She looked down at the children.
"And in all those people, there might be some who might be able to get us to safety." "You're serious, aren't you?"
She nodded.
Go if you want.
Nyla swore, looked around and then swore again.
I'll go to the bridge, he said. I know something about ships.
Mercedes heard him move away down the corridor. She bent over the still girl.
Maury,
she said, and shook her. The girl's head twitched.
Maury!
The girl's eyes flickered and opened, and her shriek split the air.
Maury, look at me! Look at me!
Mercedes held tight to the girl's hands. Maury's eyes steadied. She was breathing hard, face flecked with drying red.
Maury, you need to listen to me. We are going to be fine, but your brother needs you. He needs you to help him stay safe. You can help him, can't you?
The girl nodded once, and then again faster, her eyes twitching but not moving from Mercedes.
Noon, she whispered. Noon, is he? He's fast asleep, just like you were. He will wake up, but we need to get out of here. Father?
Mercedes blinked. She thought of what Nihilus had said about the crew being dead, about the Crimson Troopers, about the shadow creature that had been Sub-Mistress Coln. Demon. An old word, but one that was true nonetheless.
Your father would want you safe, said Mercedes. So I am going to make sure you are.
Maury nodded.
All right, said Mercedes. I need you to stand up and keep hold of your brother's hand.
Mercedes lifted the boy, his sister gripping his dangling hand. He was heavy, and her muscles ached as she took the first step towards the open door hatch. Maury's eyes found the still shape of Axinia, and she heard the girl draw breath to cry. Thick fluid was still dripping from the ceiling.
Look at your brother, said Mercedes. That's it. Look at your brother. Keep walking.
They reached the hatch.
Down, thought Mercedes.
They needed to go down to the cargo decks. She thought she could remember the route from when Axinia had taken her to see the refugees. The image of angry eyes in cold faces rose from out of memory. She paused halfway through the door hatch.
Hold your brother, she said to Maury.
The girl took the boy, hugging him. Mercedes stepped back through the door, bent down and took the pistol from out of Axinia's hand and the fresh clips from the bandolier beneath the bodyguard's cloak. She tried not to look at the woman's face.
What are you doing?
Asked Maury.
Making sure I don't fail her, said Mercedes.
She tucked the pistol and ammo under her clothes, stepped back through the door and took the still unwaking boy from Maury.
Remember, keep hold of his hand.
The Phalanx, Terran High Orbit. Brother Massac, former librarian of the Imperial Fists Legion, knew he was dreaming. He had spent the last 7 years in the same chamber he knelt in now. He and his three brothers had seen almost no one else in that time. Their armour, their weapons, and the silence of their minds were their only concern. Time had become divisions of equipment maintenance, combat practice, and meditation, repeated over and over again. The clash of axe and sword, the circle of lapping powder over yellow and blue ceramite, the slow exchange of breath, on and on. This was their duty now, to wait for a day that might never come, and to keep their minds locked from the powers that had been their craft of war. In other legions, the Emperor's ban on the use of psykers had seen librarians return to other duties, trusted to abstain from using their powers. But that was in other legions. The Seventh did not adhere to rules in spirit alone. So Massac and his brothers had remained in this chamber and on the Phalanx, wrapped in silence within and without. But still he dreamed. They always came back, sliding into his moments of rest. And recently the dream images had shaken his meditation, even when he was awake. He walked through caves of stone and through the darkness of forests he had never seen. Stars wheeled and turned. He saw the faces of creatures that were neither human nor beast, but both. He saw a woman walking through the passages of a ship he did not recognize. He saw a door open. His eyes opened. He was sweating, moisture beading his skin beneath his robe. His brother's eyes opened a second later, looking at him from across the meditation circle. Cadus, the youngest and lowest in rank, was swaying where he knelt. His left pupil was grossly dilated, the right a pinprick.
"The tides of the warp are growing stronger," said Cadus.
"Turn your minds inwards, my brothers," said Masek. "What passes beyond is not our concern. Our oaths are to endure, and that is what we shall do."
"Do you feel that?" said Solon.
The venerable codicier moved his hand to the deck beside him.
"The phalanx is moving."
Masek closed his eyes.
"Return to the center, brothers. Our eyes gaze inwards. Our thoughts are the foundations of our beings. Our duty, the life we lead."
Silence fell again, and Masek felt the patterns of meditative quieting spiral his awareness away, down and down to stillness. He would wait. But part of him, a part that had waited and listened while the storm rose in the spirit realm, knew that the dreams would come again. Battle Barge Monarch of Fire, Uranus High Orbit. The Monarch of Fire fired even as it burned. A 50-meter-wide wound gleamed with the light of internal explosions from where a kinetic shot had punched through its skin. The shot had missed vital systems by a few meters, but left flames drawing through its decks. Lines of plasma poured from its spine and port batteries. A scythe of light cut across the face of the closing Iron Warrior's battleships. There were 12 of them, main force class all, skinned by metal and wrapped by dozens of void shields. Each of them could weather a point-blank broadside from a ship that was its equal. But the Monarch of Fire was not their equal. She was an empress of destruction, and they mere lords. The void shields on 5 of the Iron Warrior ships vanished, collapsing one after another, flashing as they overloaded. Plasma flooded across their hulls. Plasteel and stone flashed to gas, melted, scattered into the dark. White vapour fumed from the Monarch of Fire as coolant breathed through its guns and hull. Its remaining opponents did not hesitate. Beams of turbo laser fire raked its shields as they flickered. On the Monarch of Fire's bridge, Lord Castellan Halbracht felt the ship judder as it drew breath to bellow again. Lights dimmed. The surge of Vox traffic chopped and quieted. Tactical displays faded to hololithic snow. A moment of quiet and stillness fell as the great vessel inhaled power from its systems to fire upon its foes. They had pulled back to the volume around Oberon. Ships and supplies still streamed from the last moon in loyalist hands. It would not remain that way for long. A cascade of explosions had stripped it of most of its defences, but even if they had still been in place, its fate was sealed. The Iron Warriors had moved through the orbits of Uranus bit by bit, taking what they could and destroying what they could not. Where they met resistance, they applied more force, brought more ships from the Elysian Gate, and replaced the ships and soldiers that fell with more. At the star fort Furan, unable to break its void shields, and with troops prevented from advancing beyond their beachheads, they had deployed 2 vast ships to overwhelm the defences. The pair had lost their names and become codes in the data looms of the 4th Legion, 1501 and 152. Both ships had been grain haulers, taken from the Imperial supply lines. Their cargo gone to feed the forges supplying the War Master's armies, their guts became city-sized barracks for tens of thousands of gangfighters, harvested from the worlds around Ullinor. Calma soporifics had been pumped through their holds to subdue the human cargo for transit. As they closed with the Furan, the gas mix changed, and frenzon and slaught fogged their holds. The tens of thousands of gangers began to wake and kill each other. Halbrecht's ships had tried to cripple the 2 behemoths before they reached the starfort, but Iron Warrior's warships cut them off. By the time the pair had reached the Furan, they had lost 10,000 of their human cargo. More than enough remained. 1501 and 152 docked at the Iron Warrior's beachhead points and opened their internal doors. Passages designed to drain billions of tons of grain now became exits for over 100,000 drug-fueled killers. The troops defending the Star Fort held for 6 hours. After it was done, the Iron Warriors opened the station to the void and let the vacuum deal with the gangers. On and on, the brutal pragmatism of Perturabo had pushed the defenders back and back again. Now the remainder of the Second Sphere fleet was battered and wounded, circling the moon of Oberon. 100 warships from 3 times that number, facing 20 times that strength. Those were odds that made for stories to echo through the ages. But this would be no last stand, no final rest in death found in fire. The burning of Pluto's moons was a ploy that could only be used once. Halbrecht had seen the enemy forces alter their tactics. There were no hidden charges or annihilating data gins laid before the Elysian Gate. But Perturabo did not know that. Machine adepts scoured the moons and stations the traitors had already taken. Already careful, the enemy became even more cautious. Large ship strengths were held back from recently taken ground. Anything that held no worth was destroyed by distant bombardment. It slowed them, and in that it proved as effective a weapon as a fresh battle fleet. In the buzzing half-silence, as the Monarch of Fire passed through its power cycle, Halbrecht reflected that, measured on the axis of time, this battle had gone in their favour. It was just on every other count that it tasted bitter on his tongue.
"Begin to divert power to engines and shields," he said softly. "Give us one more cycle of the guns. Send the withdrawal signal to all other ships."
The command crew answered with silent action. They all knew this moment was coming. They could not remain where they were. Ships closed on them from every plane of orbit, and soon the path out to the Sunward Gulf would close. But they would not fall back to the long night without claiming a final price from the traitors. Power blinked back through the bridge. Hollow displays snapped into clarity. The red gleams of enemy craft lit across targeting consoles.
"Fire," said Halbrecht.
And the Monarch of Fire roared his word into the dark. 3 warships died in a stuttering blink of destruction. Plasma bored through unshielded hulls. Reactors and munitions detonated in their bellies. They burst, showering brilliant light and gas out and out. The lights on the Monarch of Fire dimmed, but deep in her hull, power had already been siphoned to her engines. She pushed loose of Oberon's orbit. The rest of her fleet was already falling into formation, ships breaking off and turning their prows towards the distant light of the sun. Signals reached after them from Oberon, pleading and railing and cursing, carrying the rage of people who knew that their fate was sealed. Halbrecht listened to them all, hearing the bitter words as the Monarch of Fire made for the cold depths. As predicted, the enemy did not chase them. They were cautious. And besides, they had won. The signals from Oberon stopped as they reached the edge of deep sensor range. Halbrecht cut the link as the last whisper became static.
"Signal Terra," he said, taking the helmet off his head. "Uranus belongs to the enemy."
The officers around him bowed their heads at the words.
"We are beyond the enemy's likely interception range," said the senior tech priest, overseeing the ship's signal and AuSpec systems. "Do you wish to send the rendezvous codes, Lord Castellan?"
Halbrecht nodded, his eyes on the damage and casualty reports from the rest of his fleet. It had taken Dawn's personal word to convince him of this part of the strategy. It went against almost every instinct. Faced with an enemy, no matter how strong or numerous, one advanced, or stood and trusted to the strength of shield and sword and bolter. You did not yield ground that the enemy desired. But that was what they were doing now, and what they had planned to do since before the ships of the traitors had breached the gates.
"Now, in this moment, walls and strongholds are not our battlefield," Rogel Dawn had said,
his voice strong, even through the distortion-laced signal from Terra.
Our battlefield is time, and the battles we fight are to deny that to the enemy. They thirst for time, need it, and cannot waste a second of it. And so we must deny it to them. Everything must be measured against that. We cannot stop them, my son, but we can make them bleed in time and strength before they reach the walls of the palace. That is worth more than any fortress or line that is not on the soil of Terra.
I will do what is needed,
Halbrecht had replied, and sent 300 ships from the defense of Uranus into the night to wait. He had bowed his head then, and he did so again now. Over 300 ships hanging in the lightless gulf between Uranus and the core of the system. Over 300 guns that had not spoken to hold back the enemy from the Furan, or Cordelia, or Oberon, or... Would it have made a difference? Would it make a difference now? To an enemy not expecting a fresh and undamaged force waiting for it as it leaped deeper into the system, it might. It had to.
Send the codes, he said, raising his head. Bring us on course to meet the rest of the fleet.